in the rain. White bird in a golden cage, alone. The leaves blow across the long black road to the darkened sky in its rain. She must fly. She must
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this broadcast, we're listening to How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind with David K. Johnston and Jane O'Donnell, USA Today Money Reporter.
And I believe that if the Federal Arbitration Act, as currently interpreted by the Supreme Court, came up for a vote today, an act that now applies not to companies but to you and me, and bans all sorts of things that would make the system more efficient, I don't believe it would get a single vote from a single member of Congress, regardless of their political or economic views. No one would vote for this if it came up today, and it's being used by corporations as a cudgel against consumers, against small business owners in franchise agreements, I talk about one of those, and other areas to increase their power over their customers.
You talk a bit about Dodd-Frank, and it's come up recently in the campaign about whether, you know, it should be repealed in part or in whole.
I'm not a fan of Dodd-Frank. Mm-hmm. The best regulation is the least regulation. You want to have regulation that encourages virtuous behavior and inherently rewards it, and that punishes vicious mm-hmm. behavior. We had an excellent law called Glass-Steagall from 1935 when it was enacted up till it was repealed. We had almost no bank failures in this country. Mm-hmm. Certainly after World War II, we had almost no bank failures. And Glass-Steagall had a very simple principle. You want to be in the gambling business, you want to underwrite securities and bonds, or as we do today, sell derivatives. And 90% of Goldman Sachs' business, by the way, is not investment banking. It's not marshaling capital to build factories and offices. It's derivatives trading and trading in their own accounts. If you want to be in that business, go right ahead. But you can't be in the retail banking business if you do that, and you can't be in the insurance business if you do that. And banking and insurance are basically the same business. The difference is you make a deposit at a bank, you withdraw on demand. You make a deposit at an insurance company, you withdraw on event. Mm-hmm. You don't get a withdrawal if your house doesn't burn down, if you buy fire insurance. Well, when Glass-Steagall was repealed, these were all mixed. And this, I think, is just a terrible mistake. So if we go back to the simple basic principle, this business has to be separate from this business and from this business, I think a lot of our problems would go away. We want to have regulation based on sound principles rather than trying to micromanage companies, which you can't do mm-hmm. effectively if you're the government.
And the way you said it was interesting, because I think it goes to something we said before we were on the air, that people might think that you actually like a lot of regulation, but you really don't.
I want to have one side
of the political spectrum, and you're really not.
I mean, right? I'm a registered Republican.
Okay.
I'm the co-founder of a little business. I mean, it's tiny. It does about $2 million a year business that uh-huh. my sons run.
Uh-huh.
I'm also not anti-corporation. Mm-hmm. What I'm in favor of is understanding what corporations are, understanding what economies are, understanding what we've learned from thousands of years of human experience, and getting the rules right so that the economy benefits from having a system where we want people to make a profit. But you want people to make a profit by saying go die or putting your life in danger
right.
because of faulty equipment? No, we don't want that. We want to have a system where the whole economy prospers. And you make profits if you take risks, but we have to put reward and responsibility have to go together.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just look at the mortgage crisis, what did we do? We said to the people who make loans, the sales agents, and to the banks, sell this bad loan that nobody will ever pay back, and you get three times as much money as if you sell the responsible loan. And so guess what? People took the money, and then you sell the loan to Wall Street in a way that when the loan sours, it can't be sent back to the bank. So you've separated the risk from the reward, the responsibility from the reward. And by the way, who bought a lot of that stuff on Wall Street? Well, it wasn't Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, by the way. They were very late to the game, and they were criticized for Wall Street for refusing to buy these kinds of products. It was Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, and the others who were selling these things. And who did they sell them to? Why, they sold them to public employee pension funds and corporate pension funds, and now you get hit twice.
Mm-hmm. So, sure, and you volunteered your political political leaning, but so as you're listening to the campaign rhetoric, do you think one side, does Obama seem more likely than Romney to solve any of the problems you're bringing up in the book?
I think the coverage that I'm seeing of this election has nothing to do with what's really going on here at all.
What the problem is.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the Romney-Ryan plan would eliminate basically taxes on capital. Ryan would eliminate all taxes on capital. Romney would for everybody who has more than about $12.5 million of wealth. Up to that point, you'd have no taxes on capital. The few people above that would still be taxed. Well, that's a system that says we're going to let the already rich live tax-free, and we're going to put all the taxes on consumption and on labor, especially on labor. We're going to further the policy we've had of shifting things down, and I believe it would lead to dynastic wealth, and it would lead to the situation where the entrepreneurial spirit is stalled and killed, because it's the newcomer, it's the guy who grew up like I did without any money and makes a success of himself who makes the economy grow, not the person who grew up with a silver spoon in their mouth. And we would become like 18th century France. And in 18th century France, your economics were determined by who you picked as your parents, and I mean that to sound just as absurd as it does, your gender, and your birth order. And if you weren't firstborn male to an already wealthy family, too bad for you. Obama is actually the most business-friendly president in American history. And I realize there are people listening to this are going, what? Well, let me tell you what Obama's done. 100% expensing. Normally, when a company buys new equipment, builds a factory, they have to write it off over 3 to 38 years. Not under Obama. You get to write 100% off today. The best George Bush did was 30% bonus for a single year. You can write off 30% for a year. Well, in the current economic environment, it may be a good policy to encourage more capital investment. Right. I think we need to fundamentally discuss whether we want to have a corporate income tax and how we want to make it work. Secondly, Obama gave all of these tax cuts to small business, those under the guise of being stimulus that the Republicans wanted. The tax cuts are not stimulus. They're inherently anti-stimulus. They're savings. But he voted for all of these things. And the best indication is this. During the savings and loan crisis 20 years ago, 3,000 felony convictions, 1,000 of them insiders, you know, the heads of savings and loans, they went to prison. How many prosecutions have we seen in the crisis that led to the meltdown in 2008? That's right. And the statute of limitations is rapidly running out. And that's absolutely incredible. And by the way, neither side says, all right, we're going to go after these people who lied, cheated, and stealed, falsified documents. It's just if you read the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission report, which Congress only gave about $10 million to, you know, Monica Lewinsky in today's dollars was like an $80 million, $100 million investigation. They gave $10 million to it. No one's been able to poke a hole in that report. And when it came to Washington, what did Congress do? Dropped it in the round file because they didn't want to hear it.
Right.
So I think that I think Obama has been much too soft on dealing with these matters in business, and I think he has thought much too much about what Wall Street wants, surrounded himself with Wall Street people, and not enough about ordinary consumers. I think that Romney and Ryan are essentially George W. Bush on steroids. And the George W. Bush, remember, promised incomes would rise, we'd all be better off. Well, taxes are down. A lot of people may be surprised to do that, but income taxes didn't rise. Per person adjusted for inflation, they're down about 36% from 2000. Total income in America, it's down about $5.7 trillion if we had just stayed at the 2000-year level when you adjust for inflation and population. We need to have a real fundamental discussion about our economy, and we're not getting it in this election.
Mm-hmm. And what, you mentioned the corporate income tax rate.
Right.
Businesses say it's too high compared to other countries. Right. What do you say to that?
Well, again, I think we're having the wrong debate. In a closed economy, in the economy America had in the 50s, 60s, and the 40s, the 30s, the corporate income tax is borne mostly by the owners of companies. Mm-hmm. They get a lower return. In a global economy where you have this labor arbitrage of replacing American workers with low-paid workers in China and Vietnam, the best evidence is that the corporate income tax is borne by the workers through lower wages. Now, if that's true, then the argument for relief from double taxation of corporate profits just disappeared, and the argument that comes forward is lower taxes on workers. And there was recently a study done examining economic growth since 1945, connected with tax cuts, and comparing different states and counties and markets and even zip codes for some of the later years, to see if there's a connection between lowering taxes and economic growth. And what the study concluded, and I'm sure there'll be more work done on this, is tax cuts for the top, no statistically significant measurable effect on economic growth. Tax cuts for the vast majority leads to higher growth. Why? Because growth grows out of what economists call aggregate demand. You've got money in your pocket you can spend to buy things. In our little business that my sons run, we'd hire more workers if we had more business. But we're not going to hire more workers because we can get this little tiny tax cut. That's absurd. We hire more workers when we have more work to do, and the more work we have to do, the more money we make.
Right. Makes perfect sense.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
What is the single most egregious tax loopholes that companies or even rich people exploit?
Well, it's the one I've been calling on Mitt Romney to release his tax returns about. If you are already very wealthy, Jane, imagine that your parents had left you a $1 billion fortune. You can live tax-free.
Mm-hmm.
You go invest it in instruments that don't pay a dividend. And if you get interest, you take tax-free municipal bonds. You won't pay any tax on that. With $1 billion, if you make 5%, you'll make $50 million the first year. And you say, well, I got a pretty lavish lifestyle. You know, we have the company, the family plane and private schools and this and that. But we can get by on $10 million. So your banker loans you $10 million. You pay 2% interest. At the end of the year, you owe $10,200,000. Your fortune's now grown to $1.05 billion. And you say to your banker, you know, I need another $10 million next year. Your fortune grows to $1.1 billion. You've spent $20 million plus about $300,000 or $500,000 in interest. You will be better and better and better off and not contribute at all to the cost of the government. Well, if you're a hedge fund manager or a private equity manager, as Romney was through the end of 2001 when he was the sole owner of Bain Capital, government rules allow you to defer all of your income back into your fund and pay no taxes. You might have some other investments and things and some little bit of income, so you might have paid a little bit of tax, but pretty much you can live tax-free. I think if you have untaxed capital gains and you borrow against them, you should have to pay taxes on it. It's no different than selling them. If you've already sold something and you made a net profit of $1 billion, you can borrow against that $1 billion. But if you borrow, the first thing we do is assume that any untaxed gains are income and you have to pay income tax on them. The second fundamental reform we should have is something called single company accounting. If you look inside any big company, General Electric, the New York Times, it's really hundreds and sometimes thousands of little companies. Every building, every little product, every patent, every airplane is a separate corporation. That's done for purposes of legal liability. But for tax purposes, we should say single company accounting. We don't care that you made tennis shoes in Hanoi, shipped them to America, and sold them, and you, for tax purposes, take your profits in the Cayman Islands because you sold it to a paper company in the Cayman Islands and then resold it to yourself in America. You pay no taxes in America. You pay no taxes in Hanoi. You pay taxes. You put your money in the Cayman Islands where you pay no taxes. If we had single company accounting, we'd say you do it any way you want. We don't care. But economically, the company made this profit, and you have to pay a tax on it. If we did that, we could lower tax rates. We could eliminate the unfairness of the multinationals over domestic companies. By the way, that's the small businesses. That's mostly the mom and pops, the people like me, the people way above me, who have a little business. That would be a big, important reform, single company accounting.
Okay. So let's go through just some of the other solutions that you brought. We pretty much covered what consumers can do. And maybe just to explain that a little bit more, you do think people should just get very active in their communities, write letters to the editor. What were some of the other examples?
I think you should write brief, cogent letters to the editor, call radio shows. I think it would be a good idea if people would coordinate and say, here's a question we want to ask our congressman. Show up at hearings and start asking questions. And when they try to dodge it, say, wait a second, you didn't answer that, and mow-mow them a little bit. Members of Congress, yeah. When they show up, on occasion they do come to their district to talk to the constituents.
Yeah.
Some of them a lot, some of them not hardly at all. Senators and others. I think that people should contribute money to support consumer organizations that represent their interests. One of the reforms, and I quote a utility lawyer who's worked for utilities, for consumers, he's now an administrative law judge in Oregon, named Pat Power, he says for every dollar a utility company spends seeking a rate increase, they should have to put up a dollar for the opposition. Even that wouldn't level the playing field because the company knows all the info and you don't, but that way the industrial, commercial, and residential customers would at least have some voice.
Is there a consumer group or two that you actually think are doing a good job on this level?
Public Citizen has an energy group that's done a lot of very good work and pushed this. In California, there is a group called TURN, the Utility Reform Network. It's been around for 30-some years. In Oregon, there's a group called CUB, the Citizens Utilities Board. There's one of those in Illinois. Here in Washington, the former general counsel of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, Gordon Gooch, has been trying to get the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to stop being a complete tool of the companies that it regulates, particularly the pipeline companies. And they have at every turn blocked him and said, you have no right to intervene. We don't have to listen to what you say. We don't care what facts you've come up with. A total disregard for the consumer. And what happens, by the way, at that commission is people come in from the industry and they leave and they become senior executives at the companies they've just handed your money to.
Right. For a year, they can't go back and lobby their agency.
Yeah, so
but that's all you do is
I say to you, Jane, listen, you go tell the congressman this because I can't talk to him for a year.
Right. Okay. So that's what consumers can do. What would you like to see state legislatures do? I mean, on some of the different issues, we can cover a different issue other than utilities. What would be some of the most important things for them to focus on?
Well, I think if every state had a consumer advocate office, well-funded office, mm-hmm. Maybe funded as much as it's reported every corporation spent on lobbying, you would get some balance. Because the telecommunications companies, for example, are getting not just your right to a telephone taken away, but they're having the law rewritten to say, we don't have to provide service to anybody, and you, the customer, have no rights at all anymore. You're at our mercy, and the market will take care of you. Well, no, the market won't always take care of you. That's not the job of the market. So I think we need to do this. In New Jersey, the only state that has a tax dedicated to the poor was from the casino industry. Donald Trump and the rest of the casino industry wanted that money. The state consumer advocate stood in their way. They got the legislature to get rid of the consumer advocate, and then Donald Trump got $89 million intended to go to the poor, and the rest of the casino industry got 300 and some million more at the time that I looked into this. I mean, it's gone up since then. What better example could you have that a tax, the only tax in America at a state level dedicated to help the poor, gets turned over to people so wealthy they own casinos? So I think there's enough stuff, as I said, that I could write two or three more books from the research that I did about what's gone wrong and the attacks on competitive markets, the rise of these monopolies and duopolies and oligopolies, and the rise even of systems that you get to leverage one monopoly against another to really expand your profits and damage the economy through what economists call dead weight losses.
And this is the third in a four-book series?
Well, I don't know how many books we'll get out of the series. I haven't signed a contract for a new one yet. But, yeah, Perfectly Legal, which won the Investigative Reporting of the Year Award, came out in late 2003. It's still used as a textbook at a number of colleges, and the economics in it haven't changed. The numbers haven't changed much. It was about taxes, how the super wealthy game the system. Free Lunch, which came out 4 years ago, is about subsidies and about industries that earn all of their profits from hidden subsidies from taxpayers, companies that do so, that I name and identify. And there's been some movement on that. People begin to recognize it doesn't make a lot of sense to let a retailer keep the sales tax money, which both damages competing local companies and hurts the schools and the police and the fire. And then this book, the fine print,
was the idea of your editor, wasn't it?
This was actually my editor's process. I wanted to do a very different book that he he didn't like, and this turned out to be real tough because nobody had done what I've done, which is spend 4 years digging through thousands and tens of thousands of pages of court records, hearings, and whatnot. I will tell you, I have box loads of material. Somebody has serious insomnia, I can recommend some reports that will guarantee if you're not going to sleep, sit up in the bed for a little bit and...
Unlike that, this book would not put anyone to sleep. The stories were very compelling. The writing was great, and I really enjoyed reading it. And it's been great talking to you today.
Well, thank you, Jane.
It's time once again for Radio's Theater of the Wine.
Again?
Today featuring the Shakespeare classic, Julius Caesar.
Oh, we just did Shakespeare!
And Julius Caesar. Oh, God, I hate wearing a toga.
Aw, Shakespeare's so boring.
Oh, yeah.
Can't we do a Neil Simon play?
Look, it's Shakespeare or nothing, all right?
What about Romeo and Juliet, then?
Oh, that's been done to death!
If all you're going to do is complain, just forget about it. Get off the stage.
But theater is my life!
I can't hold a real job. I've got a bad back.
Can I go now?
Go, all of you, go. This has been Radio's Theater of the Wine.
You know, it is so hot on this stage. Can we just turn out those big, bright lights?
Now that is not a problem.
Oh, now it's too dark.
Yes, it's a shame, isn't it? Radio's Theater of the Wine, a Sniveling Thespian production.
Jungles around the trees. Some say it's yellow, some say red. It will not matter when we're dead. How many dead men will it take to build a dike that will not break? How many children must we kill before we make the waves stand still. streets you know, to places they would never go alone. It gives them useful trade. The lucky boys are even paid. Men die to build their pharaoh's tombs, and still the teeming wombs. How many men to conquer Mars? How many dead to reach the stars? Farewell, my wistful Saigon bride. I'm going out to stem the tide. Some say it's yellow, some say red. It will not matter when we're dead.
And now for something completely different.